really that this evening we can spend most of our time in discussion. I have found so far one slight handicap with Holden Village. One, if not handicap, at least a drawback, and that is that I am not in my own mind quite sure of how much of what I was I should bring along and how much I should leave behind. I guess from time to time I would just as soon leave it all behind, you know, and just start all over. The name of that game is what we call recreation. And yet, that's not very practical. It's not always too advisable. It's very easy to do, but in a sense it means that when you go back, you have to start all over again. And so what I'd like to be doing while I'm here is working on what I was rather than forgetting it altogether. And so this evening I thought that I would bring to you some concerns about the business that I am in, get your opinion about it, and see if we could maybe come to some creative conclusions. In addition to being a professor of art at Valpo, I also am in, I guess what you would call the liturgical art business, and that is just that description holds a lot of track. You may be familiar in your own congregations with problems about asking people to do work for the church, getting them committed to do a lot of hard labor, creative, energetic work, and then when it comes time for remuneration, you are told that it's all for the Lord and it's all for the church, and there is no remuneration to be expected. And so to make a business about doing the Lord's work, to be in the church building business, to have a studio, for example, that turns out about $1,200,000 worth of stained glass every year, just stained glass, in this day and age, I mean, you know, when people are dying all over the world and all kinds of horrible things and being ignored, to put that kind of money into glass, into permanent structures even, it raises an awful lot of questions. For a guy who is simultaneously committed to doing right by the people of God, to doing right by his own vocation and avocation as a creative person, and also by doing right to those people that come to me and say, build us a church. And of course, you know, we cannot have a church without people. An organ, preferably pipe. I mean, the more musicians you have in the congregation, the more preferable is the pipe organ. And stained glass, because it's pretty difficult to tell a church from any other building these days unless it's got stained glass in it. Everything else, you can, you know, kind of go, you can have an awful lot of freedom with. Right now, at this particular time, I am working on 19 churches. 19 building committees. Can you imagine such a thing? It is at this particular time that the church does its darndest to forget about what being the church is all about. The least Christian things are done by the most Christian people at the time of church building. The most vicious, backbiting, jaw-eat-jaws, blood-curdling name-calling goes on in the name of building the house of God than at any other time I can think of. I mean, filling stations go up with much better economy, et cetera, et cetera. So, that is a problem for me. Another problem. I just turned down an offer to design the interior of a church in Tennessee. I won't tell you what the denomination is. The church costs $1.75 million. $1,750,000. That wasn't just for the church. They had four bowling alleys with automatic pin centers. They had six tennis courts. They had a TV viewing room and a cinema theater room. They had a section for old folks, middle folks, and young folks, et cetera, et cetera. And then they had a church. Well, it's about time, you know. But they a really nice, a good part of their budget was spent for a worship center. They wanted this place to be a community for the Christians in that area that people could come to at any time. I mean, it was, a very admirable thing. And yet, the one problem was that for $1,750,000, the total amount of time that was to be spent in the worship room was 94 hours a year. 94 hours a year. Now, of course, we talked this morning with Norm's class about, you know, obeying the Sabbath. As far as the church is concerned, it does a good job of doing that without obeying an awful lot of the other commandments that come along with that. And one of the most important seems to be that of stewardship. Church building in this day and age is the most expensive, least economical kind of building of any kind of building going on. And one may get the impression that there is less church building going on now than ever, and it is not true. It is not true. For another reason that is going to present another one of my arguments. The idea occurred to me, you know, I'm always thinking up titles. What would I call tonight's forum? And I thought of something like, a place for worship, who needs it? I wasn't trying to be sarcastic or sacrilegious, but the need for a place for worship seems to be the last reason why people build churches. And this is disastrous. You know what the most important reason is? The reason most people give for having to have a church doing it is so they can get more people to come to church. That's why nobody is going to come to church if we have to worship in a gymnasium. They want us, you know, a building. They want a church that looks like a church. Whatever that means. suggested to some congregation in Illinois that they build a catacomb, and they immediately fired me. Looks like a church,
It's a long way from home.
Good enough for a lot of people. It wasn't good enough for Illinois. At any rate, how many good reasons are there for having a place to worship? Now that's important. That is extremely important. We're talking about stewardship. We're talking about incredible money at a time when there is not enough incredible money to do what the church needs to get done. Right? Okay. At the same time, you have in most of the large cities empty churches, an awful lot of empty churches, which are being turned over to all kinds of institutions. One of them in downtown Chicago is turned into a restaurant with psychedelic lighting effects and so forth, and the people sit in the pews. They just have them, turned around with tables in between. That's a fabulous place. Really nice. They still have the old-fashioned altar up there, that you can walk around. It's frightening in a way. Yeah. What a place to celebrate the Eucharist. In a restaurant. That would really be fantastic, with the pastor in the kitchen. Being a real servant. Would be magnificent. But the church quit. The church quit the city, like an awful lot of churches are quitting the city, and moving out to the new ghetto, which is the suburb. So, what do we do with all the old churches while at the same time we are building new churches? Well, one last question. If we were to really be traditional, and this is what everybody wants when they build a church, right? Give us a traditional church. And by tradition, what we really mean is as far back as I go, not as far back as the church goes. It's my tradition. Well, if we really built a church in the tradition of church building, which is the only tradition that seems to make sense, then we would have to build a church like nobody has ever seen before. We would really have to do that. In fact, if every age required of its architect what our time requires of our church designers, we would still, in fact, be worshiping in catacombs. Since the Byzantine architects would be required to build in the tradition of those people, which was catacombs. And then the Romanesque would be required to build in that tradition also, of the Byzantines, who copied catacombs. But no, every age, absolutely every age, required of its places of worship those styles and arts and worship forms that grew out of that age, that served needs that were peculiar to that special time. And therefore, it is heresy to assume that the Gothic is the most spiritual architectural form for building a church. It is not only heresy now, it was heresy at the time of Gothic church building. If the church at the time that Gothic churches were built thought that that was true, then I suppose it would be true that the closer you got to Rome, the more Gothic you would have. When in fact, Boston has more good examples of Gothic architecture than Rome does. Rome, the whole of Italy, thought Gothic architecture was foolish. In fact, it was Italy that called it Gothic. And that was 600 years after the Goths had been extinct. It was a dirty word put onto northern architecture by the Italians who were still worshiping in Basilicas. So it was not a universal art form then, and it doesn't make any sense to demand a form that came out of an age that is very, very little related to our own. So much has happened. So much has happened socially, economically, scientifically. My God, people, 90% of what we know about the world and science we have discovered in the last 40 years. It just doesn't make sense anymore, if it ever did, to demand a prior age's solution for our own worship spaces. And yet we haven't. We still insist on them. No matter how we clean them up, no matter how modern, how whitewashed they are, it is still a fact that in 95% of all architecture that is called church built today, the thing that the average parishioner sees the most of as he is called to admonish one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, the most that the average parishioner sees is hair. Hair. The backs of people's heads. That's true. That is true. You still have an inaccessible altar, an inaccessible priesthood, and people sitting there as though they were waiting for the lights to go out and the movie to start. And you know it. In fact, the average theater gets you closer to the screen than the church gets you to the altar. They got better sense, the people of darkness, than do the children of light. They know where it's at. But the church doesn't. And if you would require us as a congregation to all of a sudden now celebrate the Eucharist, I mean right now, at this very moment, get out your hymn books, people, and let's say, "Awake my soul, and with the sun thy daily stage of duty run." Well, the first thing is a raft of self-consciousness brought on by having to look at people's open mouths. How do you admonish one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs? By looking at the back of people's heads.
If you don't really do that, I think that you're being a little sarcastic. Don't you think that in realistic terms that we can blank out that fact? What are you advocating? I don't think what you're saying is true, although what you may want to say is true.
What do I want to say?
I don't know.
What I'm saying is true. What I'm saying is true.
I don't see the back of his mind or the truth.
What do you see?
I never thought of it until you mentioned it.
What do you see the most of when you sit there?
I don't know, but I don't see the big idea.
You gotta know what you see when you go there.
No.
I see the stained glass.
Right. Ah! Right on. Well, you're coming away with something in value, yeah. Anyway.
No, and it depends on what the focus point of the church is. There's
sure.
Different churches, but I don't see the hair, no. You said this morning we don't all see the same thing.
That's
right. I would support Peter there that I don't see hair.
You're not aware of...
I'm not aware of hair. It may be there and occupy a large part of my visual field, but I don't see it.
What do you see?
Well, I say it would depend on the church, but it would be some focal point probably that I'm looking at.
What?
I would usually something on the altar or the front of the church.
Okay.
No, what I see are the pipe organs.
Oh, okay.
That's funny.
What else?
Windows.
Oh, windows. Does anybody see people? Minister?
When he's...
Okay, the minister. The minister when he's preaching.
When he's preaching, I see him, yes.
Oh, no, he's not. When we're singing, when you're singing, is he up there? Is he? Bless his heart. That's rare. Oh, okay. Yeah, holy smoke. Oh my goodness. No, that's right. That's right. There is plenty going on in that case. There's a tremendous amount of drama in your ritual. Something happening all the time. Okay. All right. No. What I suppose that what I'm trying to say is that it doesn't quite seem natural. I guess it depends on what we're talking about by liturgy. You know, why do we go there in the first place, you see? I mean, what is the reason for going? And it seems to me, now jump all over me, please, because this is my, you know, this is my business and I'm super sensitive to it, but it does seem to me that if liturgy is to reinforce, is to make joyful, is to make a value, is to help us celebrate what we are during the week, an emphasis, in fact, which I didn't get this morning in Norm's thing about the Sabbath. Because that's right, we are all one body, but that body doesn't all come apart when you leave the church, right? And a foot is not a finger. We still are we are still hooked together, even though we go our separate ways. Okay, so we go into our vocations, we go into our homes, into our families, into politics, into all kinds of stuff. And we come together for worship, not forgetting what happened during the week, but helping to celebrate that. And say, you know, Mama, I think that's really incredible, having a hand, you know, as part of my body, like what you are, and why aren't you being paid an hourly wage, you know. Or, thank God for you, Paul, because you're the mayor of my town, but you're doing some stupid things, brother, and I would like to talk to you about them here. But I'm going to celebrate you in this place. Now that seems to me to be part of what liturgy is about. And we do this in reminding ourselves of our baptism, which, by the way, is a daily drowning and dying. The average church's baptismal font looks like an empty aluminum ashtray with a dead fly sitting in it, and yet that's supposed to be our symbol of baptism. It's ridiculous. Water is the business, not font. Water. Okay, well, we can just go into this all week, for that matter. But we bring what we are during the week, and we celebrate it. We don't forget it, right? And yet, what happens in church that celebrates what we are during the week? The meal? I go to at least 150 churches a month to talk with people. And in a vast majority of them, they eat a meal like soldiers, all lined up in a row. My family goes in there, and how is it with most of you? For me, it's exactly like it was when I was a kid. On the way to church, Mama sticks the handkerchief into her mouth, gets it wet, sticks it into the ear, wipes off the dried cereal, and gets as much of the grape juice as will come off. You get to the parking lot, and you say, okay, kids, that's it for an hour and a half. I don't want to hear boo out of you. We all march in there sober-faced, and we sit there in a line. And don't turn around. There's a kid back there. And if you got kids, don't sit in the back of the church. They all get together and gang up on you. You take them down to the front row and keep them in awe. And let them just sit there with their mouths open, you know. And we all sit there in a row. And when the usher comes, we all go and we celebrate the Eucharist in a row or at the Valpore Chapel. 75 people in a circle, and we come away from that Eucharist as though we had been kicked in the backside. You should see the sober faces. I mean, it is the most somber, serious, and retrospect. Good grief. That's exactly what it's called. Good grief. Yes. If it became dogmatic, your last state would be worse than your first. That's right. No, I guess what I'm saying is, do we need a place for worship, a place for the community to gather? Do we need it? I mean, I'm asking it very seriously. It's at a time when an awful lot of the church is splitting up into little sections. There are what I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, cell groups, worshiping in the home. I think of this also as being extremely important for young people. Where do they go and what do they do when it comes to worship? Do they worship novelty as much as they do the priesthood of all believers? Do they worship Christ? Is that the focus, or is it, oh, I don't know. But assuming that there is a body of Christ in any given community, does it need a place for worship? And is there something about our time that should give some direction towards how this thing should be thought about when it is constructed, as there has always been before? A unique approach for a unique age. Whenever there was a unique age, there was this approach. Now, what is there a unique approach that is viable for our time, and that is going to take into consideration all of the splintering, all of the segmenting, all of the factionalizing? I would like, Carol, if you're around in here somewhere, to have a prayer for the Missouri Synod sometime in chapel. God help us. How do we do this as a community of people who want to worship? Can we say, let's give all our building fund money to the poor and worship in homes, or worship in as one congregation is in Chicago, worshiping in a motel, so they don't have a building budget? What is the church, as Marty has said, on the move, and should it be housed today in tents, as it was in the Old Testament? Yeah.
An observation I made when I was in Hawaii, others may know about, but one Anglican Church here has a beautiful church on the 12th floor of the retirement home. It's a beautiful place. But their most effective ministry as far as doing things right now, or it was a couple of years ago, was on the beach with the people who were gathered there. What did you do?
Well, you see, that goes back to this problem of what I said was the dominant reason for building churches, because you thought that's what brought people in.
It doesn't.
No. The church is people. And if the people aren't going into the community and doing the work of being the church, then the building that they bring the people to is going to be a mockery. It really will. And, of course, there is so much idolatry connected still with how we build and why we build. We still call it God's house, the house of God. What do we mean when we say that the church is the house of God? Really? What do we mean? That's where he is? Or she? Or whatever? I'm getting nervous about that. Mama's been reading too many books lately, but really, is that where God is? What happens when we lock the door? You know, Sunday noon, he's in there. You know, we got lights hanging over altars. What does an altar mean? What is an altar? What is a pulpit? Is a pulpit the symbol of the word? Not in part.
And
well,
was the house of God, and so we just carried it.
Yeah.
The temple was built in the Old Testament. The temple to the Old Testament people was God's promise, and we got a real cast upon the temple. That type of a church is no longer needed because Christ has come to build it.
Yeah, the pillar of fire, the pillar of smoke, the sanctum sanctorum, that holy of holies behind the veil. That veil's been split. That thing was rent from top to bottom, or bottom to top, but it's gone. It is gone. But you're right, the terminology is there. But what about the meaning? How much are we still hanging on to, you know, that really has so very little meaning, at least for our time? I'm not trying to be an iconoclast. I'm really trying to ask questions. And of course, these questions are going to be answered differently from community to community. I am sure that an urban community is going to have to answer these questions differently than a rural one. And that a congregation with scads of young people, wherever it is, you know, we'll have to answer it differently than a congregation that is maybe like the one you were referring to in Hawaii. But, you see, I spend so much time with a congregation before I assist them in building, and we talk about, we pass around questionnaires. What is an altar? I don't know. What is an altar for? Do you have to have one? What does it mean? What does it symbolize? What has it got to do?
Those are awfully profound questions, but you said that a church is people and that the building committees want to build traditional churches. Now, your comments are kind of undemocratic.
Oh, why, sure. No great work of art was ever done by a committee.
Well, but how do you get around that? How do you get around that problem? The problem being that if the church is people and the majority of the people want something...
Yeah, but do they really know what they want?
Well,
have they thought about it?
That, okay. Yeah, you can ask that question.
Okay.
But I think probably they do. I mean, I come up with it.
They do what? Know what they want?
Know what they want. Mm. I think they would know what's good for them.
But maybe they haven't been shown alternatives. Mm. Maybe they're just kind of stuck in the gut, and this is what should be, but they don't really, you know, start too much about it. And as far as alternatives.
Well, that's possible. That's possible. But I don't think it can be answered theoretically. I think it has to be answered experimentally.
I have
one of the last projects that I had was a congregation south of Milwaukee that built the most fantastic hyperbolic paraboloid concrete bird that took off from the top of a hillside. It was just fantastic. And 2 years later, they still hadn't figured out where to put the altar. And they called me in after it was built, and they were trying to figure out how to arrange seating. The architect said that he refused to be an interior decorator on this project, and that was their problem. Now, of course, they were really foolish to hire such a man in the first place. But I think, you know, there's an awful lot of costly experimenting going on with very unsatisfactory results. Yeah.
To make it possible to have a more successful and more meaningful worship experience for the people in a structure in which the people dislike or are neutral to than in one in which the people are worshiping the structure or are a part of the work of art and proud to be a part of this great thing that they own. Something that they're almost attaining to show people to the devotees. In other words, should the structure be the means of working?
Okay. Well, of course, that's my question. Mm-hmm. A place for worship. Who needs it?
Some places don't use a place.
Some places don't use a place.
Well, what?
Well, it seems like you're crossing two different things. You're crossing an institutionalized church with a church of God. And it seems like you keep throwing it back and forth. And I think there should be a terminology put on an institutional-type church and a church of God. Because I think there is a difference.
There is a difference.
Yes, there is the art cross.
Yeah.
And it keeps going back and forth. We don't need a worship place, and yet, you know, a specific wall to put it in.
Yeah, of course, the question that I ask is foolish because it depends on so many criteria. You have to know so many factors, like one of them, like you ask, are we talking about a congregation? Where is it? What is it composed of? How does it worship? Is it ripe for change? You see, congregation I'm working on now, a small church, a small town in Iowa, 9,000 people. They have 4 Lutheran churches, and this congregation wants to build a Lutheran church right across the street from another Lutheran church that was built 2 years ago and is half full. You see, now there are questions there that aren't going to apply to every instance. So you got to say, all right, let's pick on them for an evening. Let's dig in on that problem. But underlying the whole problem is they say, as a congregation, as a worshiping, gathering body of believers in that town, they've got to have their place for worship. That is important to them.
What did the early church, why did they worship in catacombs? Catacombs weren't built just to worship. They were
no.
There, obviously, weren't they? I mean, there was no special building going on in order to come up with a place.
Well, not,
is that right or not?
Not for a while. They worshiped in the home. They sort of had community homes in which they
large homes in which they worshipped in for special celebrations. Then they went to the catacombs.
They were hiding out.
No, they weren't hiding out. They weren't hiding out.
Were they just hiding their place of meeting? Is that it?
Rome was, there are so many, you know, that sort of Cecil B. DeMille that they were hiding out.
Wasn't he right?
Of course. You better believe it, lady. Seriously, Rome was in a bad state. But can you picture the Roman police force being so stupid as to not be able to track down 5,000 Christians who are all gathering in one place? At that particular time, Rome was about the size of, in population, of, 50, 60,000? Small.
Oh.
It really got tiny. Oh, it was full of disease and all kinds of stuff, but there was no way you could get it. No, the catacombs were safe. The catacombs were hands off. Nobody arrested anybody in a catacomb. That was a Roman law.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Holy ground.
Yeah. Sanctified ground. That's right. Can you imagine all these people sneaking around drawing little fish in the sand, and nobody?
That is what they did in the movie.
Sure they did, but it was a sign of reconciliation and a sign of identification. It wasn't trying to sneak over anything on the Roman soldiers. Quarter of them were Christians.
Well, if they weren't if they weren't trying to hide out, then why the necessity to go to the catacombs where the wedding
for celebration? They did. They went down there to celebrate. The whole early church was a kind of cult of the martyria. A cult of the martyria.
That's not what I learned when I was studying. The Christians were becoming such a strong organization that they were perverting the Romans of the time, and they were becoming a threat to Rome.
Sure.
And this is why they had to go into the catacombs.
But not to hide out.
Well, they couldn't worship openly.
That's right.
Then they knew who they were, and that's why they had to go down there. But
the reason for the catacombs, though, is not just simply to hide out. In other words,
the catacombs were already there. They were burial places.
And they were, and more important than just burial places, the Christians were dying like flies. Obviously some of them didn't make it to the hiding place, you see. And they were buried in those places. Some of the early saints were buried in those places. Some of the people who knew the apostles were buried in those places. The early bishops, six of the, come with me next summer and I'll take you to the catacombs, huh? And it's exciting. It is really exciting.
In Washington, by the
way. Huh? Pardon? That's right, yeah. That's right. They do. And so the early church fathers, you see, let me enlarge on this.
I don't understand why they went to the catacombs.
They're
ugly places there.
Oh yeah, they are.
Dark.
But let me get this one idea across, and this may not even be part of our conversation, you know, but it, why they had to worship and the place they picked was very important. It was all one piece. They didn't immediately go building basilicas, because those catacombs were very important. Even after the church was official, they still worshipped in the catacombs, when they could have started building basilicas above ground. And when they built the basilicas above ground, where did they build them? Above the catacombs. Right next to them. You know, you see, they didn't go into the suburbs. Oh, I guess the catacombs were already in the suburbs. Well, I just lost a good example. No. Look. When the church
begins. Its first important relics, its first real connections, its links with Christ are so important that they immediately go to the Holy Land and get relics. Not only that, but they go to the Holy Land and try and discover the sites where Christ did his work, where he was born, and they, and so forth. That's for Constantine, 330 and so forth. All right? So, okay. So there is, as soon as the church becomes official, a need for the church to identify itself with what we call iconography of place. Okay. I'm talking about what? What am I talking about? No.
I mean, when it's become more and more of a ritualized, formal kind of religion.
Okay, yeah, right, right.
But that's not the beginnings of the Christian church as the apostles started.
No, but you see what happens to the apostles. When the apostles go to Rome, when they go to Ephesus, when they do all of this, all of the special work that they do, those places where they do them become those places that the early church reverenced. And where those places are, and where those saints are buried, where the people who then knew the early Christians and who knew Christ, where they are buried, it is incredible how much the early church, before it becomes official under Constantine, is what we call a cult of the martyria. Martyr, meaning witness, not meaning somebody who necessarily just dies, but somebody who knew the man. That is an incredibly important thing. Even the place that knew the man becomes a relic, you see. And so the church goes underground and gets its hope underground. Almost everything that is written, not almost, absolutely everything. I cannot think of one example of any work of art done in the catacombs, and there are thousands. I cannot think of one of them that talks about death. Every single one of them talks about hope, about resurrection. And in the presence of those people who are guaranteed by Christ eternal life. And some of these symbols and signs are just incredible. Little children, little boys and girls that are buried there and are called saints. Little Martha was eaten by a lion yesterday and is now eating at the heavenly banquet.
If you go to Denmark, you'll find in some of the old altars there a grave carved down in the altar, and that used to hold a fingernail or a
piece. Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, an average Missouri Synod church will require of an altar that it be at least 7 feet long and 2.5 feet wide. Why? Well, they don't know why, except that it's always been 7 feet long and 2.5 feet wide, as far as they know. That is not true. The original church had for an altar something which today would approximate the size of a card table. It was a meter cube. It was like a card table, and then they had beautiful fabrics from North Africa thrown over the top of it. Just big enough for the book and the vessels, the sacred vessels. That's all. But then, huh?
That has been the the beginning of the formal church, but the
in the catacomb.
Back to the original church.
Down in the catacomb.
Such as this, they had no church structure as such.
Oh yes, they did.
No, not the early ones.
They built a basilica in the catacombs. Has anybody been to the catacombs? There is a two-story basilica underground.
That was built when?
Hmm?
That was built when?
About 200 A.D.
Yeah. So I'm talking about from the time of Jesus' death until the beginnings of the formal church. It was a community such as this.
Well, and the beginning of the formal church is 330.
Is what?
330.
Yeah. But up until that time, they didn't have the structure such as we have today.
Oh, no. No way.
They just didn't have the houses.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, the early Christian basilica took on very much the form of the house, of the Roman house. It had a courtyard, an atrium, with a well in the middle of it, which became the baptistry. You see, and that's how the baptistry became separated from the church. That's, you know, as in the Catholic tradition. And the Romanesque people still use that. When they had all the pilgrimages, all the guys had come with their horses and carts, and they'd walk and take them into the atrium. These were the first ecclesiastical Howard Johnsons. They slept out in the atrium. And the horses drank from the baptismal font. Yeah. Even the Gothic cathedrals were stables when they weren't being used for houses of worship. They stored grain. All kinds of crazy things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you want to carry that analogy, what happened down in the catacombs was one little congregation above ground meeting with another little congregation, a small community, and another little congregation, and they got together for their, they were worshiping in homes, in secret, above ground, and then they got together for the big, large thing. When the bishop came, or when a letter came from one of the elders or the apostles. And then they went to the catacombs for the celebration. So that church in Iowa ought to really build one, you know, all the Lutherans ought to get together and build one big one, you know. And they ought to worship in their little block houses, you know, have little block communities. And when they need to get together, then they all get together in one church. Of course, this is happening also, not just among Lutherans. In fact, it's almost, it's not happening among Lutherans, let's face it. In fact, the average Lutheran would rather worship with an Episcopalian than with another Lutheran, I think. It is, I know, it is, and thank God for it. No, it's happening in Valpo. But mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, are they combining building programs and stuff that you know of?
Ministry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fantastic. And, of course, there are also interdenominational ones. I'm trying to design something now for a community in Nebraska in which there is a synagogue, an Episcopal church, and a Methodist church. Now, how do you do something for all those, you know, and make it come out like it's got a little gumption to it? That's really a difficult combination. But they really, I think their main problem is one of finances, but they are getting together and trying to fulfill a common need by pooling their resources.
Why do some of the churches want to build a new church when their old church is going to be so expensive? And it's not falling apart or anything.
That's right.
After the building, you want to build that.
Yeah. Yeah, the new ones don't last as long as the old ones. Say again. Say it again, please.
Yes, you were talking about the altar. Why is the altar there?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you came down to the marchers, and I thought you were...
Yeah.
And so I wasn't coming back again.
Something came up. The church then needed those relics. And the best relics they could find were the martyrs themselves, who were buried all over the landscape at that time. So they went down to North Africa, they went to Jerusalem, got back the body of St. Mark, brought back the body of St. James, brought back this body and that body. Where would they put them? The highest place in the church. Well, they had been worshiping at card tables up to that time, and the saints couldn't fit in a card table, and so they elongated the altar, made it 7 foot long by 2.5 foot wide, and we have inherited a sarcophagus for an altar. In fact, during a lot of the Gothic age, the top of the altar would have a little hole cut in it, and during the service, the priest would dip a handkerchief, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 handkerchiefs, through the hole, onto the body of the saint, lift it off, and auction it during the service as a relic. Yeah. And that is our, quote, tradition, end quote, for having an altar of such a form or such a size, you see. It's a little scary. That's one of them. Yeah.
I don't know where I am as far as seeing all these new churches being built. I represent the American Lutheran Church, the Division of American Mission.
Mm.
And the 22 new ministries we got last year, not one of them was started in a building. As far as I can think of in the North Pacific District, that would be my Christian church. Again, thinking in terms of existing congregations, there are very few new buildings being built. I've traveled extensively throughout the district, and I'm wondering just how many new buildings we're building today. There might be places where this is happening. I just don't see it.
This is ALC?
ALC.
Well, I'll give you the name of six of them in two states that are spending right now. I'm working on their designs right now. The combined total of six are spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $35,000 for glass.
I don't know where this is. I'm just saying.
But that's right. No, look, I like glass, and I like people to design places to worship. I really do, and not for myself, but for people. For one thing, I think it is absolutely necessary that people come together, that people meet, that people see as their responsibility as Christians people, not just things. I can't help but believe that there is a need that people have to share who they are with one another. And I'm not talking necessarily about a Sunday thing. I'm talking about a place. A place. It's not God's house any more than my house is God's house. And it is. If it isn't, then all of the people who live in God's homes, if there's no God in that home, aren't going to make a church. You see? But I think there is a need for assembly, for building each other up, for celebrating, for taking care of each other, for feeding each other, for training of young people. And I'm not talking about parochial school. But, you see, I just don't quite see how this jives with what is actually being done. It really worries me.
See, you're talking now about modeling, forming styles of ministry, models that have the origination out where the people are.
Right.
And then whatever structure comes will be that which fits the model of that form of ministry.
It's incredible. That's exactly right. You see, a couple years ago, the Missouri Synod decided to have a high-rise apartment ministry, and they set up a program down in Dallas, Texas. And they sent a guy from a parish congregation, and they put him on the 14th floor of a high-rise, and they gave him two adjoining apartments, and he built a little church inside these apartments. Got pews in it, and stained glass, and the whole schmear. And I thought, my God, this is incredible. You know, he just took the whole thing up the elevator and parked it up there, you know. What is it about not allowing the people and the needs of people to determine the worship structure? You see, and this is going to be, what about, for example, the ministry to labor? To labor. Factory. The minister to the factory. How's he going to get by with moving a chapel into the factory? No way. But there is a very important ministry that's going on in the labor industry right now. And it requires a place. It does. It requires a place according to the law that says, let everything be done decently and in order. It really does. I believe it.
I had some friends in Seattle who had a parish in a laboring community,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't have a lot of money, and they wanted to make their church more beautiful. It was the ugliest church, according to Arnold Slotin in the Synod. And so
he would know.
The president of the church was a plumber, and he had a lot of tiles. So they took the tiles and they made the baptismal font out of tile. It looked a little bit like a jazzy bathtub, but it was neat, you know, in a way. I mean, all the parishioners had, you know, liked wine, and they had a lot of wine bottles, so they broke them up and they made stained glass windows out of it. Well, this is a architecturally very conservative church. They liked their rows. They mm-hmm. felt comfortable with their rows. Mm-hmm. They didn't change that, but they wanted more color, and so they did this.
Yeah.
And at once a week, Floy would have her classes in broken glass windows. She showed the women in the church how to make them, and they all did it, you know. It was neat. But
this is the sort of thing.
That's not the kind of thing that, I mean, I wouldn't go to Central Lutheran in Minneapolis and say, move out that pipe organ and break your glass.
Right.
I mean, that wouldn't be, that's not the point.
No, that's right. And in fact, that came out of a particular need at that particular time, too.
You go as far as to say that it should be like that St. Paul's time, where he was the 10th carpenter, whatever you call it,
mm-hmm.
and then he could preach inside.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in Denmark, it's like that, but the theologians, they even have been going down to the ground sometimes. And
yes.
If you go as far as to that, then they would have, let's say, 15 or 14 hours somewhere in the factory, and then go back to the community in a shed somewhere with broken glasses.
Yes, I would. This is happening in the States. Pastors who are truck drivers for a certain amount of time during the week. A small country community in northern Indiana, where the pastor runs a bulb farm. He's got he grows bulbs. Yeah, bulbs. Gladiolus. Glads. He grows gladiolus, and very, very successful, but he had a barn, and it had all of these old bulb trays, you know, just crates that had been used for years that he used to pack the bulbs in. And that whole barn now has been sided on the inside with trays. The altar is made out of bulb
trays. Everything is made out of bulb trays. And the pews are benches. And the whole thing that happens there happens out of the community, not out of any, even right aesthetic from the outside, but of a necessary aesthetic from within that congregation. And well, it's like getting a call at 2 o'clock in the morning from a young pastor in New Jersey who says, "We dedicated our church. I mean, we have finished building our church. It's all complete, and we're not going to consecrate the church until 2 weeks from now. They finished early. Are we allowed to go in and use it?" He calls me, and you know, across half of a country, to find out whether or not he can go in and worship in a. I don't understand this. I really don't understand.